Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
Exciting news. Ammon Anderson, aka The Guy, going on the Gamer Cruise next year with me, is also having a new tile-laying game, Twinkle Twinkle, out at Allplay. In the game, you're going to be filling your star chart with these cool, clear plastic tiles you're trying to connect to build constellations and belts of asteroids. You're also collecting comets, picking up planets, and studying them with satellites. So you gotta take care to avoid those pesky black holes, unless you have the perfect spot for them, of course. Whoever finds the highest score in the stars win. A really cool feature, beyond the fact that there's these cool acrylic tiles that are clear, is you can actually point your phone at the night sky, and then it's going to actually show the scoring right in front of your eyes. Of course, this is optional, but a pretty neat feature, so you get to magically watch it tally up all your points. The game is available on allplay.com along with the expansion and the mini expansion. This game is for 1-4 players and takes around 20 to 30 minutes to play for ages 8 and up. So check out Twinkle Twinkle from Allplay. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 121, Shifting Stones. Today we are joined by J. Evan Raitt, the designer of Shifting Stones. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to dive in because I am a massive fan of anything game right and also abstracty puzzles, and this hits both of them. But before we jump in, what got you into designing games?
I mean, there's probably a lot of things. I always liked puzzles and mazes when I was a kid. My mom was very big on the family game nights, either Hearts or Chinese checkers or something like that. The spark that really got me was actually, I got the Pokemon Master Challenge board game when I was a kid, and it frustrated me, and it is pretty infamous, and I wanted to create my own version of it that more matched the old Game Boy games. And so I created one that was like the size, it took over almost my parents' entire garage. It was so massive, and I just really enjoyed it, kept making games up until college. And one of my professors was like, hey, what's this little game that I made? It's like this checker like abstract game, and I'm like, I like making board games. He says, that is so cool, how about you do an open elective on that? I created a game for an open elective, and ever since I'm like, hey, this is awesome, I can actually do this quite a lot. And yeah, that's kind of really a big spark of how it came to be.
What initially inspired the design of Shifting Stones?
It actually started a couple of things. The main inspiration, especially how the stones came to be, was through the Mayan glyphs. If you look at Mayan glyphs, they're all in squares. And each square actually has like, it's like almost a sentence. That just was like super interesting to me. And I wanted to create a game like that. And I had a couple of pieces of some other games lying around and kind of put them together. And that's how Shifting Stones kind of came about.
So then for anyone who hasn't played the game, mind going over how to play?
Yeah, sure. Shifting Stones is a pretty simple abstract game for 1-5 players. There's 9 stone tiles in the center of the table, and each of the tiles has a front and a back, and there's a different shape either on the front or that's on the back. Also, players get game cards, and each of the game cards has a pattern as well as a point value. What you're trying to do is use the cards in your hand. You can discard a card to take any 2 stones that are adjacent to each other and shift them into position, or you can discard a card to flip them over to the other side to get the other tile side, and use the remaining cards in your hand to match the pattern that's on the card with what you have out on the tile board. As you do that, you score points.
And basically the game ends once you hit, I believe it was like for 2 players, 10 cards, 3 players, and it's like slightly less cards each way. And every player has its own reference card. I like that the reference card kind of shows the tile makeup as far as what's on the front and what's on the back.
Yeah, that was actually one of the big things that I had always said I needed to have. And that was like the first thing when Game Right saw it, they go, so why don't you have that yet? I said, oh, I'm working on it. And so that was something that we put together. And one thing that they did that I didn't in one of the testing ones is they really looked at making sure that the front really also worked with what the back was. So like you have the seed goes into a tree. You can also intuit like what is on the front and on the back.
Okay, I was going to say, because I feel like it would be a really difficult game to play without that reference card, but knowing that there is in the artwork a hint, that's good. I guess I didn't catch it.
Yeah, there's also the bird is catching a fish. If you look at the bird and fish ones, I always find that one to be fun.
That's super cool. And so how did you end up getting connected with Game Right?
One of those weird stories of you know someone who knows someone who knows someone. Where I live in New Hampshire, there was a board game cafe that started up, Boards and Brews, and I got to know one of the co-owners. He introduced me to one of the owners of another game cafe in Boston, who created a little thing for people, for designers to play at PAX, or showcase their games at PAX East. And so I bought into that, and he played the game. He absolutely loved it. And then so he introduced me to Game Right. From there, it was like very shortly after, Game Right called and said, hey, we want to sign your game.
Wait, was this Devin?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I am unsurprised that was Devin. I was like, who do I know in Boston?
It's one of those things where, like, as I'm just kind of getting connected with all these different people, it really is like who you know for this kind of business.
Yeah, you never know what conversation is going to carry on to some opportunity down the line. But yeah, no, Devin, who owns Night Moves Cafe, he's a great guy and I'm friends with him. So I like to go visit the cafe as much as possible because I'm like, best case scenario, traffic, hour and a half away. Normal, it's more like 2 hours.
Yeah, I got a bus ride. I have to go in order to get there. Absolutely worth it. Support your local board game cafes.
There you go, because you might get your games signed. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly.
So what kind of like changes happened then once Game Right took over and started producing the game beyond just making you get a reference card?
One of the biggest things, and I think this was a little bit of like, I actually was planning on it for before when Game Right took it over, and there was a point total from 1 to 9 for all the cards. So like there was 1-pointers, there were 8-pointers, there were 9-pointers. It was a bit of chaos. And that was one thing that like drilled down as soon as they got it. And actually the biggest thing that we collaborated a lot on it was actually having a little bit of a bonus. In my original concept, there wasn't the bonus for having the most 1-point scored cards. In most of my testing, having some end game bonus wasn't necessarily something, but they really wanted to have it. And we kind of discussed various options, and that's where we landed on, was whoever scored the most 1-point cards got a little extra bonus of 3 points. It didn't completely change the game, but it does sometimes matter. So it was kind of fun to add.
And did you always have the currency of you play a card in order to do the shifting action? Essentially, you're flipping the adjacent tiles, right? So horizontal, vertical, not diagonal, and then also flipping the tile over itself?
No, it was always you have 2 actions. I can't remember exactly what the like spark was for discarding cards, but I'm pretty sure what it was is at the time players might have had like 5 or 6 cards in their hand just normally. There was just so many particular options. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm just going to shorten the number of cards that were in players' hands. Players then started saying like, I don't have a lot of like choices to make. It's like, it's very simple to do this or that. And it was one of those things that really racked my brain about, okay, how do I put a little bit more like choice and a little bit more spice into the game? And I think somehow it came to be that I'm like, you could have as many actions as you wanted, but how do I limit it? Because I don't want players to just kind of go crazy. And somehow I landed on discarding cards is your action. And once that happened, that was kind of the big turning point for what made the game like a fun activity into what it is.
Yeah, because I find it difficult when you're pattern building using a central area that is controlled by multiple players. I think 2 movements is hard if you have nothing that can be done in 2 movements. But if you can have that ability to spend up to 3 of your cards because you need 1 to score, that becomes fun. I know you also have the optional choice of just gaining 2 extra cards. But you're not able to do it over again. Was that to allow for more flexibility? Do you see that people use that a lot? Was that a choice you made?
So that was part of the original choice. And I do kind of feel like, you know, I could have gone with my original plan of everyone drawing 3. Because I do think that the drawing 2 is one of those things that, like, you know, players do it. Like, it is something that everyone does say, but it isn't as strategic, or it isn't as beneficial, because skipping a turn can sometimes really just not be worth the two extra cards. The reason why I added it was I wanted to ensure that when you draw a 5-point card, that became much more difficult. Once I like shortened how all the points worked, it was one of those things where everyone is always a card short, always a card short. I'm one action short. I wanted to have something to just be, you know, add a little bit of extra, like there is more to your decisions to be made of like, oh, I can draw a couple of extras. And I tested a whole bunch of different numbers. I think I landed on 2 to be safe. It can be used. And I think it is pretty good, especially in like 2-player games. Is where like it can shine the most.
Definitely makes sense. And was it your idea initially to have like in the visuals a reminder of the front and back? Was that in your first prototypes?
Kind of the tiles, there's a set of 3. There's one set that's a set of 3. There's a second set that's a set of 3. There's a set of 2 and a set of 1. And I definitely had sun and moon as the 1 because that was just a perfect selection. And then the set of 2 was, in my version, was like a flowing thing of water coming out of a vase, and a volcano was on the other side. So it kind of was like a opposite thing. It wasn't necessarily like I didn't have an intentional, oh, this is definitely the true pure opposite of the other, at least at that time. But it makes more sense, you know, to have done it that way. I think I'm not super as artistically minded. I have a friend who helps out with a lot of my artistic side stuff, and she came up with some incredible work for what it was, and to help at least pitch the game.
That's great that you had someone able to help you, because I feel like when a game is so streamlined and is like an abstract, having a visual can really carry it, such as like Boop. I always use that as an example. Like, it didn't get signed until it had the cats bouncing on a bed. How did you feel the partnership with GameRight went? Did they kind of take over? Did you work hand in hand with them? How did that go?
It was absolutely fantastic, and it still is. It was really great. We had a lot of back and forth. They would approach me, you know, saying, oh, like, what if we were to do this or do that? Or what do you think about this or that? Like, the biggest thing that always gets to me is they gave me the 2 possible covers for the box. We were all like, oh, what is it gonna be? Because they're so good. So, fun fact, the art that's on the back of the cards was the other option for the board box art. I had always, when I built like my prototype box, it was always like the 9 symbols on the front. And that was just like a really iconic thing. And it like explains what you do with the zones on the table. So it was just something that like we had to go that way. As much as that other art was so, so good, we just kind of knew, yeah, we got to go with a classic look. And I think it does help. You know, it is a different look for the game.
It is a very striking cover. When I saw it for the first time, I was like, ooh, I want to play this. And I did pretty much immediately. It did its job for sure. And it sounds like it's still in print and it's still like reprinting.
It does sell reasonably well, which always surprises me. And, you know, from everything I've heard, at least so far, GameRight is still very happy with the game. So I'm very pleased, especially for my first like real published game. It's like I definitely hit something good. So I'm very proud of that.
That's awesome. And how long in total do you think it took from that initial inspiration of like the Mayan ruins to it being out and published?
If you kind of take into account that there was probably a lot of breaks and handling other, you know, projects and stuff, probably like 3 years. When it really started to hit, like I probably spent a solid 8 months really crafting every bit of it truly. So 2 kind of answers there. 3 years, and then at the very end, like a very focused 8 months.
I mean, it's the journey. And as someone who does work on so many projects, there's certain times certain kids need more of your attention.
Yeah.
So did you have like a favorite moment and a least favorite moment of the experience of the design?
My favorite was definitely when I bring the game to a bunch of friends who, some are very board game minded, others are not. They decide that they're going to give it a try begrudgingly. And then like, you know, 10 minutes in, they're like, this is great. It was like during kind of like the midpoint of the big design, I'm like, I've got something here, because they're now going nuts with it. Now they're like yelling at each other. You flip that over. You've turned that, like, having just a lot of fun with it. And that was like, I got something. And that was a huge, big feeling for me. I could actually do this. I can actually make a game that people really like. And that was a huge boost to me. In terms of things I didn't particularly care for, I think I would probably have to say it was kind of like when I'm working on something and I'm get kind of stuck and I'm not necessarily feeling like this is it. It's kind of the almost the opposite. Like I'm kind of already feeling in the rut of it. It's not really going anywhere. It's not really being solved. Like as an example, like I'm, you know, trying to figure out how am I going to limit the number of actions a player can do. And I have no idea. Like there's like a million different ways. And why don't I just keep it the same way it was? You just get two actions, deal with it, have fun. But like, no, that's not fun. How am I going to solve this? Those kind of deeper questions like do kind of then it's like the opposite, kind of put the brakes on it. And I'm like, now I can't do this. So those are like the things for me that stick out as like the bad stuff. But when something good's happened, I am full steam ahead. I thrive on that.
That definitely makes sense. Did the game originally start as like a 2-player? Or was it always 2-4?
So the original like first version of the game was a 2-player game. And it actually had 16 tiles. And each tile was also split into 4. And you would put cubes on the individual 4 spaces and try to like match the patterns of the cubes. It was probably crazy, but still kind of fun, but it was way too much. As I took things away, because that's like half of game design is taking everything away from your miraculous first draft. I started to be like, okay, I need to have more players because this can work with more players. So I can add more. How many can I add more? Can I do 4? Yeah, I can do 4. Can I do 5? Yeah, I can do 5. And then the big thing actually for me was like figuring out, can I do this with 1 player? Can I make this a 1-player game as well? And very lucky that I was able to find a pretty awesome solution to that.
And what was the solution?
So you take a certain number of 1-point cards, 2-point cards, 3-point cards, and a 5-point card, and you kind of shuffle them up and to create, I think it's like 18 cards altogether. You have a smaller deck. The idea is that you have to score at least once in your hand of 4 cards. And if you can score at least once, you're good. But if you can't score, you take a strike. What you're essentially trying to do is score every card before you gather 4 strikes. It's one of those things where you're having to be like, okay, am I going to score this card now? Because I can, but I don't want to. I already scored a card, so I'm safe. And I'm going to keep this card, even though I can score it, because I actually need to keep cards to score as I progress, because I need to eventually hit my 5-point card at some point. And so it became a really cool like puzzle, and it surprised me how many people who have played the solo mode say that, no, this is really cool as a solo mode. So I was very excited when it was really working out for a lot of people, and that it has gotten a lot of like praise as being a pretty solid solo mode.
That's really cool. I didn't realize it went 1-5 players. In my brain, it was 2-4.
Yeah, I would say give it a try. It can be kind of roguelike almost in a way.
I am also very jealous that you had Quan Chai do the art, because he is amazing, and I hope to someday have some game that he did the art for.
It is kind of funny. When they presented me the various artworks, like they didn't tell me who was doing it at the time. I think it was like very close to like when it was going to start being like discussed and released, and then I found out who it was. I'm like, oh my gosh, like how did I get so lucky?
I was like, you got Game Right and you got Quan Chai. Oh, I want to have your life.
I still can't believe it. He did an incredible, incredible job. And with the production value that's on the stone tiles themselves, like it all just works so well together. I could not be happier with how it turned out as a product, which was the greatest thing about working with Game Right on this, is like how seriously they took turning this in. Like it was this mysterious thing. Like it may have a backstory. It may not. What ancient civilization had these gigantic stone tiles? Like, and I was always imagining like a small little tableau of like, you know, the explorers going into a place and there's like this little pedestal with like stones, and they decided, you know, Quan Chai decided to go all out. They're gigantic. They like live in the world. And I'm like, oh, this is so good. I'm very blessed to have had such an incredible team work on the game that I designed.
It definitely turned out amazing. Did you have the initial name picked out, or they switch it to Shifting Stones?
No, I had the initial name. And I think actually the name came really early when I was, you know, thinking about the Mayan glyphs, and like, I knew I wanted a game that like you're shifting things around to create patterns. I knew that's what the idea in my mind was. Flipping actually came much, much later. When I went from the 16 down to the 9, that's when flipping came about, because I'm like, there's so much less for me to do now. It is weird. So the concept of the shifting around came from a really old discarded trading card game idea I had, because every game designer has a trading card game idea, where like the way to do your summoning for mana system was creating runes in a particular pattern. I actually played that with some friends, like, hey, try this mana system, see if it works. And they're like, oh yeah, this is cool. Like, are you going to be done with the game now? What are you talking about? Like, I still have to create thousands of cards and all this. No, this is fine. Keep this. And so I always had that kind of hidden away of like, oh, I've got like this cool shifting mechanic that I can use. And that's eventually how I'm like, I love like the Mayan glyphs. What can I do? Oh, I got that glyph idea. Let me pull that in.
I feel like it's such a cool thing to use those like tools from before, even if you had like a fully made prototype that never goes anywhere that you can dissect from. But any of those ideas never really go away. It's probably why so many companies, they like sign away your brain if you actually do work full time as a designer, because they're like, oh, well, something you make now could be it later. I don't fully believe in it, but it is true. You never know where inspiration is going to strike or when you might pull something from the past, whether it's one of your games or a game you played.
I've got a shelf that's just full of like old prototypes and concepts. I have a, you know, massive drive of notepad documents that have all of my ideas. And it can be ideas as simple as just like a sentence of what I want to see a game be like, to entire rule books that don't even have a prototype. They just kind of decided, I'm just going to make this and see what happens. Yeah, so I have a lot of like shelved ideas. Like, actually, pretty recently ago, that concept I was talking about that I designed in college, I pulled that out and I played it again, because I'm like, I wonder if this does have something now. Like, maybe I can use this. And the thing that always gets me is, okay, maybe it does. And then I start working on that for like 2 weeks before the next project pulls me in a different direction. And like, oh, I got to put that on the shelf again. I think every designer has like at least 10 games on their particular shelf. And I would love to like just see the sizes of some of these greater designers out there and like how big their shelves are.
Don't look at mine. Mine's more than a shelf. It's scattered around my apartment. It's actually kind of a problem. It's a good thing I live alone, is all I'm saying.
It's a library.
It's not that bad.
Oh, okay.
But it is like multiple drawers. Yeah, I'm bad at breaking up with my old game ideas. I should really toss them and just know that I can reprint them. And yet I don't. I don't do it.
No, you see, you can't do that. I mean, that's one of the things I do agree with when a lot of people say like, no, keep your old stuff. Like, that is the one thing that I do hoard, is I will keep my old stuff. And because I do think that at least sometime you may end up really wanting to use it. And it's not like a piece of equipment or something in your house that like takes up a whole thing. At least put it in a document, save that somewhere. So at least you got something, because you never know where something might actually hit. I had one project I'm starting pretty soon to work for a contest. It's one of those things where I had this idea and I built this prototype and I'm like, oh, this is the most insane thing I've ever created. And I don't think anyone would ever go for it, but I just like creating it because I like creating. And had it, I don't want it, but where am I going to put all of this stuff? And I took pictures, I digitized it, put it in its own little folder, and it's all good. It's all there.
That's a good way to do it. Yeah, I keep a lot of my stuff in just handwritten journals, but I also put it in Google folders as well for the actual like digital prototypes. And Tabletop Simulator, oh, I have over 200 games on there that I made. So it's a good thing I didn't keep all those physical prototypes. It'd be an issue. So what do you feel like was your biggest takeaway from this first experience of doing Shifting Stones?
That is a good question. I do think that I'm not exactly sure myself. I would probably say it surprised me how fast things did move once it was going. You know, I did assume that, like, oh, you know, even though it's a smaller game, it's not like I'm building some 3-hour table slog. I still kind of, you know, understood at least a little bit of, like, processes and logistics and being like, oh, you know, it's going to be this amount of time and this and that. Oh, we've got some art. Oh, we've got some this. Oh, here's a update to the rules manual. Oh, every, like, 2 weeks, you know, I got a new email of, hey, we want you to check this out. And it surprised me how fast it moved during the production. Maybe kind of small, but, like, I did kind of assume that, like, oh, this is going to be something we're going to still take a little while. No, when they were on it, and they put it together real quick.
Oh, that's so nice. Did you enjoy having that kind of interaction with the publisher?
Yes. I have to say that that was probably my favorite part of the whole thing, was, like, talking with GameRight and talking with a lot of people from GameRight, because when I would go to PAX East again, I would see, like, oh, the, you know, marketing people and talk with them about, like, you know, what they're working on. And it really was, like, an incredible experience. I do hope that whenever my next project ever does get picked up, that I would have something similar to that again, or even beat it. Like, that would be the hope.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is if there were any projects fans should be looking out for. Or I know that just off air, we've talked about a possible spiritual successor for Shifting Stones.
One of the biggest sets of feedback I have always gotten from the game, and I don't necessarily always read all my 1, 2, or 3-star reviews, but I do sometimes peruse. And obviously the biggest point of feedback is, it's just random. Like, who cares what your turns are? It's all just random, whatever. And, like, yeah, I know, I get it. One of the biggest answers to that was, I tried to create an updated version. It's not exactly at all the gameplay of Shifting Stones, but it's it has that kind of similar creating patterns mechanic. I put together, like, this really thing, and I've been having it for a while. Not really sure where it's going at the moment, because a couple of things that probably still need to be worked on and whatnot. But I do have the benefit of having, like, a 9-to-5 job that I love probably more than game design, which is probably crazy. So I tend to, like, just work on games like an art form versus, like, you know, this is how I'm making some money.
I think that's probably healthier than what some of us are doing.
So for me, you know, I have that luxury to be like, I'm going to take a break from this. I'm just going to try and, you know, tinker with this. So I'm still kind of working on it here and there, but definitely when it's ready, hopefully start seeing it somewhere. But at the moment, I don't necessarily have something. But I am taking a bunch of things off the shelf and really kind of putting some finishing touches on things and gaining some feedback on a lot of other projects that have been ready to go for quite a bit of time, getting back into the swing of things on creating some pitches and whatnot. So maybe hopefully soon I'll have a whole bunch of stuff ready to go.
Yeah, I hope so. That'd be awesome. Well, then, for my final question of the podcast, unrelated to everything we've already talked about, I would love to know, if there was a game out there that you had wished you had been the game designer of, what would it be?
So, interestingly enough, keeping with GameRight, I definitely would have loved to have created Sushi Go. I deeply enjoy everything that Phil Walker Harding puts together. He's probably, like, has been kind of, like, one of my inspirations as, like, a designer who creates a lot of the games that I would love to create. I would have loved to create that.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you haven't listened to the episode, he was my 100th one, so I interviewed him.
Oh, I did.
Oh, okay, good. I did. You're like, yeah. I am a fan. Yeah. I was prepared for this question and definitely did my homework.
Oh, yes. Yes. I listen to whenever I have a chance to hear from him, or also like anyone from, like, Asmodee Games, whenever I have an opportunity to hear from them, like, those are another set of designers I really enjoy. That was actually, like, I think probably the first episode I listened to when you had approached me. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll start here. So, yeah, that was great.
I think that's a smart move. I like when someone just goes through and is like, ooh, that's a fun game, and then clicks it versus just, I mean, like, subscribe, sure, let's go. But also, pick your favorites. That's more fun in the beginning. And then if you like it, subscribe and follow. Well, to everyone who's been listening to this episode, thank you for joining us for this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 121, Shifting Stones. And Evan, thanks so much for being on the show. Is there anywhere you want people to be following you to track kind of these prototypes or, I don't know, things on social media?
I do have a Blue Sky. It's ER Game Design, but I don't necessarily use it too often. So I usually only use it for, like, big announcements and stuff. If I do have a game signed, it'll be probably posted there.
Well, I hope that announcement goes. I just followed you, which is super professional while recording. And yes, and so I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're looking to find me on my personal social media accounts, you can check me out on Instagram and Blue Sky under the username TokenGamer, spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. And as I mentioned, we just launched for Game Design Unboxed some fun new short form videos and other cool stuff on an Instagram and a TikTok under the name Game Design Unboxed. And you can also check out our website, same name. Thank you again, Evan. This was great. I'm glad we got to chat about one of my favorite abstracts.
Definitely appreciate it. Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, inspiration to publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out NoDirectionPodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at Let'sAllPlay.com. Join us next time.